In the coming week, the U.S. and its new U.N. ambassador assume the presidency of the U.N. Security Council. The U.S. intelligence community releases a report on the Jamal Khashoggi killing, and the country of Georgia faces a mounting political crisis. It's February 25th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, in the coming week, the United States will assume the presidency of the UN Security Council. And in the last week, the Senate confirmed Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield as the U.S. permanent representative to the UN. Could you tell us a little bit about Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield, Bob, and the work she'll be doing as part of the Biden administration's foreign policy team?
Absolutely, Jim. Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield is a 35-year veteran of the U.S. Foreign Service. Among the posts she's had is included ambassador to Liberia. She has served most recently as Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She also had postings elsewhere in Africa, in South Asia, in Europe, Caribbean. She's worked on refugee and migrant issues. She's well known among sort of the global diplomatic corps, and the announcement of her appointment and then subsequently her confirmation was greeted by a lot of veteran diplomats around the world. She declared diplomacy is back at the UN once she was confirmed and has talked about, using a play on words, what she's going to emphasize, which is gumbo diplomacy. She comes from Louisiana. It's worth mentioning her personal story a little bit too, Jim. She grew up in the Jim Crow South, so the segregated U.S. South. She worked her way up as the first in her family and as the oldest of eight children, the first in her family to graduate from high school, went on to receive bachelor and master's degrees before getting into the Foreign Service. And she's seen as someone who is going to bring the U.S. back into more of a leading role at the U.N. at a kind of a crucial time. The Trump administration didn't completely pull out of U.N. affairs, but it's safe to say it saw the U.S. as, in its America First approach to foreign policy, saw the U.N. as playing a less important role. And the last person to serve as U.S. Ambassador, Kelly Kraft, her position was relegated to a non-cabinet position. It was now elevated again under incoming Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield to a cabinet position, meaning that she will be attending the highest level U.S. government meetings and therefore assigning the U.N. its sort of greater importance. This was something that two ambassadors previously, Nikki Haley, also had. And it's a number of other recent ambassadors have had this status as well. So President Biden is trying to send a signal here about, with this first major ambassadorial appointment, that the U.S. is indeed back. And with the U.S. taking over the rotating presidency of the Security Council, is able to set the agenda and sort of indicate priorities at this high level chamber, the U.N. Security Council, where you have seen a lot more of sort of the initiatives coming from China, especially, than from the U.S., as we had seen previously.
Bob, I know that Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield went through a Senate confirmation process. She was asked a lot of questions. Obviously, the senators on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee know that the United States is about to take over as president of the U.N. Security Council. So during the confirmation hearings, did we get a sense of what Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield is going to be prioritizing in the U.S. term as president of the UNS?
Yeah, I think we can see already from some of the things that more broadly the administration is moving on, and we can start to see that take effect. So first of all, although it won't necessarily be a focus of the UN Security Council, the U.S. has announced it's interested in rejoining the UN Human Rights Council, which the Trump administration had withdrawn from, criticizing it, as have previous administrations, for overly focusing on Israeli abuses and not really going vigorously and fairly after other countries that have been accused of rights violations. And in fact, allowing other countries with poor rights records to serve on the council. This is an issue that comes up a lot in the U.S. about whether it should belong or not belong, and whether having a voice on a body like the UN Human Rights Council can be effective. So that's one thing. I think the Security Council, which has its agenda is sort of dominated by issues of peacekeeping and conflict on the continent of Africa, there will be regularly recurring meetings on that front that it will be interesting to see her voice on those things because of her deep background in African affairs. That's going to be very interesting to watch. But I think more broadly, I would expect to see, and I haven't seen a confirmation of this yet, but some sort of a focus on the COVID response, especially helping to galvanize a global response to vaccine distribution, for example, as a global security issue. And maybe climate change as well, Jim, that the administration wants to get moving on global climate discussions and motivating actions to show some sort of vigorous response to the ongoing climate warming and sort of take some efforts to arrest the carbon emissions that are taking place. So I think I would say climate, COVID, possibly as two leader items, the regular affairs of the council, but you could also see the Iran nuclear discussions coming up in some form in the council because of the P5 plus one, the permanent five members of the council plus Germany. Germany are the lead nations on that Iran nuclear deal.
And to go back to Ambassador Thomas Greenfield's invocation of the idea of gumbo diplomacy, what is that likely to mean in practice? I get gumbo. I've had it in Louisiana. Delicious to eat. But what does it mean in practical terms as an approach to diplomacy?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's personalizing in some ways. It basically, by being there in person, and this is obviously, and the hope is that there will be much more in-person type of encounters taking place at the UN and at the sidelines of big UN events. But it's taking a personal approach to the affairs of state, to talking over thorny problems that come up in which countries are seemingly at major odds, and talking them through, and maybe talking them through over a gumbo dinner or some such thing, as the ambassador herself mentioned, an approach she likes to take when dealing on diplomatic affairs. So it's kind of a down-home approach to communicating. And it's something that's, I think, some people welcome in terms of putting a more human face on the U.S. approach to international affairs, perhaps, where it's willing to listen and willing to engage countries and hear them out and then pursue its interests, but maybe pursue its interests while, you know, incorporating some of the other issues and concerns of other countries. So I think the proof will be in the pudding. It's going to be interesting to see how she takes that, how she pursues that from her perch in New York. And I'm not sure what specific issues it might be more effective with, and whether or not, you know, the issue of China, which I mentioned, Jim, is something that comes up. Will she, you know, engage Chinese diplomats in ways that we haven't seen at the UN in recent years?
Well, we'll see if anyone soon starts writing books about gumbo diplomacy.
Absolutely. I'd love to see it. And the accompanying cookbook as well, Jim. Jim, I want to turn our attention to U.S.-Saudi relations, more specifically the pending release of a report from the U.S. intelligence community on the role of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the killing of U.S.-based dissident Jamal Khashoggi. Jim, this might be coming out as we are taping this podcast during the course of today, but what are we likely to hear? Or what does it mean for U.S.-Saudi relations?
What we're likely to hear, Bob, is that the U.S. intelligence community has concluded that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, otherwise known as MBS, directed the killing of Mr. Khashoggi back in the fall of 2018. Now, the finding itself is not a surprise. Senators who were briefed at the time on what U.S. intelligence had learned came out of their classified briefings pointing the finger at the Crown Prince. You may recall that Senator Lindsey Graham memorably said at that time, quote, "There's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw," end quote, a reference to the fact that a bone saw was used to dismember Mr. Khashoggi's body. I think what matters now is that the report's coming out in a very different context. And if you go back to 2018, 2019, the Trump administration, and particularly President Trump, is very solicitous of the Saudis in terms of his approach to the country into the region. You may recall that Bob Woodward last year released tape of a conversation he had with President Trump, in which then President Trump essentially said that he had prevented Congress from going after MBS. We now, however, have a different president, Joe Biden, who isn't likely to be solicitous to the Saudis. In fact, hasn't been. You may recall during the 2020 election campaign that Biden promised to make the Saudis, quote, pay a price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are, end quote. And his policies since coming to office have not been friendly toward Saudi Arabia. Obviously, he ended U.S. support for the Saudi-led intervention in Yemen. At the same time, the Biden administration is trying to get back into the Iran nuclear deal that the Saudis bitterly oppose. Now, we're told by the White House staff that the president is going to make a phone call in the very near future to King Salman, the 85-year-old ruler of Saudi Arabia, and also the father of the crown prince. And this phone call is designed, in some sense, to limit the diplomatic fallout from the release of the intelligence community's report. And I should note that the administration has made a conscious decision to release this report. It was not released by the Trump administration, again, reflecting a difference in the approach between the two presidencies. I imagine a lot of people would like to listen in on that phone call. And I would imagine also that Biden staffers are hoping that no one has briefed King Salman on the fact that Biden has said that there is, quote, very little social redeeming value in the present government in Saudi Arabia, end quote. Those are not the kind of sweet words of diplomacy likely to bring countries together. And I think the real big question, Bob, is going to be where U.S. U.S.-Saudi relations go from here? I mean, it is clear that Mohammed bin Salman is persona non grata in the United States. Don't expect him to be touching down for visits in the future. But you also have to keep in mind that he's likely to be the next king of Saudi Arabia. And that could happen sooner rather than later. And whether Americans like it or not, Saudi policy decisions matter for the United States. And if the United States chooses not to woo Saudi Arabia, Beijing and Moscow most certainly would be happy to do so. Now, of course, diplomacy is not for the sentimental. And the big question facing the Biden administration is, can they take the current situation and turn it to the advantage of the United States? A lot of people have commented on the fact that the Crown Prince, who really is sort of the public face of the Saudi government, has taken a number of moves in recent weeks, like releasing prominent dissidents that have been interpreted as efforts to try to build a bridge back to the United States and do things that are likely to take off some of the heat that he faces. And now you're getting a lot of speculation as to whether the Biden administration will try, and if it does try, succeed in perhaps leveraging the current situation to get the Saudis to recognize Israel's existence. We have talked in the past about the Abraham Accords, and if you were to get Saudi Arabia to recognize Israel, that would be very significant because of the role of Saudi Arabia and the role of the royal family in Saudi Arabia as the guardian of the two holy mosques.
Yeah, Jim, it's a lot to process there, but I think the big thing that sticks with me is, you know, how tough can Biden be if, you know, you have this, what is expected to be pretty damning report coming out about the direct role of the Crown Prince, and a phone conversation is one thing, but then is the U.S. then going to follow that up with, you know, not only perhaps, you know, moving in the direction of some sort of gestures on the Abraham Accords, but is there other steps the U.S. would take in terms of its arms sales to Saudi Arabia, which are considerable, or even moving to sanction the Saudis? Or we're just kind of in new territory here, I think, because this relationship has always been so important and so transactional, actually, as President Trump pretty much flatly acknowledged in the last couple of years of his administration.
Well, we've already seen the arms sales scaled back, and I don't expect the Biden administration to be as forward-leaning or as generous as the Trump administration was on that score. We have already seen some sanctions placed against, I believe, some of the individuals that were involved. And I should point out, because the Saudis would note this, that there have been trials of the men who went to Istanbul and carried out the actual killing of Mr. Khashoggi. And I believe 8 Saudi citizens were convicted in that trial. 5 got the death penalty. The death penalties, though, were later rescinded or commuted, supposedly because Khashoggi's relatives had forgiven the perpetrators. My sense is that the assessment of most international observers is that was more a show trial or a farce. It wasn't a sort of even-handed, neutral carrying out of justice. And of course, the individuals who were involved in the killing all have very close ties to the Crown Prince.
And that took place after initially vehement denials of any Saudi involvement whatsoever. So yeah, I think it certainly appears highly likely of some sort of a show trial set up, but, you know, enough to save face with some quarters, perhaps. This is going to be very interesting to see how the administration plays it. Again, the administration has been not only in the president and candidate Biden's comments about his feelings towards the Saudis, but also this sort of values-based, you know, foreign policy, you know, how far they're willing to take that is going to be tested yet again.
Certainly will be, Bob, but let's change gears and talk about Georgia, the country, not the state of Georgia. Earlier this week, Georgian authorities arrested Nika Melia, the leader of the United National Movement, the ex-Soviet nation's main opposition party. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that Washington was, quote, deeply troubled, end quote, by Melia's arrest and urged the Georgian government to avoid actions that could further escalate domestic tensions. What's the tone in Tbilisi right now, Bob?
Well, Jim, it's quite tense. I mean, it has been mounting and ebbing and surfacing, and then it just really built to a froth just in the past several days. Well, for one thing, the previous prime minister had stepped down just a few days ago after protesting the move to arrest Mr. Melia. The new prime minister, Irakli Garibashvili, said the arrest was justified, however. And so you have a hardening of the position of the ruling party, which is the Georgian Dream Party, and you have a certain hardening on the side of the opposition forces. And Georgia is a very divided country. We've heard a lot of that happening around the world, frankly, including in this country. The stakes stakes here are such, though, that it's really democracy at stake. And this is a country that has been long called kind of this rare pocket of democracy in a part of the world where if countries aren't outright authoritarian, they have very troubled democratic experiments, shall we say. The entire sort of rim of the former Soviet Union, not counting the Baltic states, has had quite a year of upheaval. Belarus continues to be in the throes of demonstrations. Armenia and Azerbaijan went to war again, and Armenia is dealing with its own fresh protests now. Kyrgyzstan has had protests over its elections. And it's worth noting that the election controversy that has incited this latest round of protests stems from the elections in October that were deemed to be, on balance, free and fair, deemed by organizations like the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. But the opposition is not having it, and it's basically saying it's calling for new elections. So Mr. Melia is seen as kind of a firebrand who will continue to foment protests. The charges that he was arrested on, Jim, stem back to 2019, the summer of 2019, when there were major protests, some of the biggest protests in years, that erupted after a Russian lawmaker sat in the parliament speaker's chair during a meeting of lawmakers that were from Orthodox Christian countries. That set off a huge set of demonstrations, protests, some actions which hurt demonstrators, and it's been burbling ever since then. And so what it comes down to is you have these two major political parties, the Georgian Dream Party and Mr. Melia's United National Movement. Both are Western-oriented, both embrace democracy. The Georgian Dream Party, though, is more inclined to be accommodating towards Russia, shall we say. The Georgian Dream Party was founded by the country's richest person, a billionaire, Bidzina Ivanishvili. He is a businessman who made his fortune in Russia. He still has ties with Russia. And so that is the sort of the crux of a lot of the concern there. Georgia and Russia have very fraught relations. Russia occupies two breakaway Georgian regions, which constitute 20% of the country. So you have these very deep-seated feelings right now that it's hard to see how they'll ebb. And it does seem like there's going to need to be some sort of intervention by the nation's partners in the West, Europe or the United States.
But let me ask you about that, Bob. What is it that the United States or the Europeans could do? And I ask that because of two reasons. One, you note that we've seen democratic regression in many of the countries in the former Soviet Union. And also, as we alluded, we're talking about Saudi Arabia. The Biden administration has set out, at least rhetorically, its desire to push for democracy and human rights issues, making it sort of top of the list of foreign policy priorities. Okay, so Secretary of State Blinken says that what's happening in Georgia is troubling. What is the United States going to do?
Yeah, I think it's a really important test of that. And I think it's a careful use of carrot and stick, I would say. I mean, Georgia has been a very loyal ally in many ways to the U.S. It sent, for example, some of the largest contingents of troops in the so-called Coalition of the Willing after the U.S. invasion of Iraq and ouster of Saddam Hussein. It has also supported other U.S. counterterror efforts vigorously. It has been eager to, depending on the governing party in charge, it has been eager to join NATO. It would love to be closer to the EU than it currently is. It really wants to improve ties. And this is true of both major parties. It wants to improve ties with the United States. So I think the leverage there could be some sort of an inducement to some sort of stronger economic ties, perhaps, Jim. And again, I don't know what kind of formula of carrots and some sticks might be necessary to make that happen. But it does seem like you have a political class in Georgia that could be willing to take some of the U.S. advice along with some of the incentives. But what those incentives are, I haven't seen any, as you say, beyond the words from Secretary Blinken, from the U.S. Embassy in Tbilisi. Otherwise, I have not seen any sort of concrete offers. It is worth saying that Georgia has been a country that there's kind of a core of foreign policy activists in both parties in the U.S. Congress who see Georgia as a really important country and a really important part of the U.S. democracy outreach. Senator John McCain famously said after the Russian invasion of Georgia back in 2008 that we are all Georgians. You don't have that sentiment quite as strongly now, but you do still have, I think, admiration for what Georgia's trying to do. It is a country with a really rocky sort of independence path so far, though.
I'll just note that Washington may try to pull some levers. The Europeans may try to pull some levers, but I suspect that the Russians have a lot more levers to pull and have a lot more stake in what happens in Georgia.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Jim. I would just note, I happened to be in Georgia two summers ago, and right around the time, actually, of these initial protests, I was with a group of a traveling choir group, actually, from the U.S., of all things. But aside from us, I would say the vast majority of outsiders visiting the country were Russian. Russian tourists famously love to travel in Georgia. A lot of the signs are in Cyrillic or in the Russian language. And Russia is this presence there, absolutely. And it's obviously physically very close to Russia. It used to be a favored spot for Soviet leaders to vacation in and so forth. So yes, just by physical space, it's it's in Russia's orbit. However, it has a very independent spirit and a feistiness and a real yen for democracy. So it's going to be very interesting to see how, again, yet another democracy challenge is responded to by the Biden administration. Well, Jim, it's that time of the podcast where we get to our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Jim, our audience selected the figure 6,500 plus dead in Qatar. Jim, what's the significance of this figure this week?
Bob, our listeners are referring to a report that came out this week noting that some 6,500 migrant workers from five South Asian countries have died in Qatar since it won the right some 10 years ago to hold the World Cup. World Cup will be held in Qatar in 2022. That's a staggering number when you put it in perspective. In a country of some 2.5 million people, of whom nearly 10% are foreign citizens. And the thing is the death toll of migrant workers may be substantially higher. Again, the numbers here are based on migrant workers from India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. The numbers don't include the death of migrants from other countries such as Kenya or the Philippines, which also send many migrants to Qatar. Now, the news is in a way surprising because you may recall back in 2015, there was a spate of stories about the terrible working conditions of migrant workers in Qatar as they were working to prepare for the World Cup. And at the time, the number that was being tossed around was somewhere in the range of 1,200 migrant deaths. And at that time, the government of Qatar said that it was taking steps to address the problem and make sure that the problem didn't continue. And however, clearly it does continue. Now, I should note that the Qatari government says there's really no news here, that the number of deaths is consistent with the size of a migrant expatriate workforce. And part of our problem in trying to judge the number and the severity of the problem is that we don't have good numbers on how these migrant workers died or what led to their deaths. The government of Qatar classifies the majority of them as deaths from natural causes, but Qatar does not carry out autopsies for deaths like this, so there's no determination of the exact cause of death. And I should note that the Qataris don't require autopsies, even though the government's own lawyers about 7 years ago suggested that that should become standard practice. And it appears that the definition of natural causes is quite broad. So if you die of heart failure, respiratory failure, it's classified as a natural death, but there isn't an examination of why a person had the heart attack or suddenly couldn't breathe. And the allegation by critics of the Qatari government has been that people are having heart failure and respiratory arrest because of the appalling working conditions that they face, and that many of these people have died while working on building the infrastructure for the World Cup. And it's, again, truly monumental, the task that the Qatari government has taken on. It's built something like seven new stadiums. There are new roads, public transport system, hotels, and everything else one needs to be able to host the World Cup. But migrant workers are, as happens not just in Qatar, but many countries, working incredibly long hours, dealing with substandard safety conditions, and for much of the year, extreme heat. You know, if you look at where Qatar is located, temperatures in the summer get quite high, and there's good reason to believe that migrant workers are being required to toil in extreme heat, not being given the sort of precautions to avoid heat stroke and sunstroke and things like that. Many of them live in dormitories that are substandard and the rest. And so this is a story, I think, that is brewed up, and it gets back to a big human rights issue. We talked about the Biden administration. I haven't seen any public comments by the Biden administration on this issue. Doesn't mean they haven't said anything. I just haven't seen it. But it'll be interesting whether this is an issue that the Biden administration picks up and tries to deal with, whether it does so publicly or perhaps more effectively to try to do something quietly through private channels. But we'll see. But again, if you look at Qatar in this issue, we can probably find similar instances of the maltreatment and substandard living conditions forced upon migrant workers in many countries around the world.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that especially in that part of the world, this sort of the wealthier Gulf Arab nations that really heavily rely on these foreign workers, many of them tend to come from South Asia, some from Africa. It's an overall name for the system, the kafala system. And as you take a sweep across the region, you'll see some countries have sought to reform efforts that had been widely criticized for almost like serf-like treatment of these workers. And it's not clear to what extent Qatar has done anything to reform in those areas. It's also not clear whether, you know, what kind of leverage that matters can move the government to take any more steps. I haven't seen any responses so far from organizers of the World Cup, for example. Just like we may not aren't hear anything from the, you know, International Olympic Committee about China as it prepares to host the 2022 Games. So 2022, you know, for the Summer Olympics and for the World Cup could be taking place in countries with increasingly questionable, if not, you know, horrific human rights violations.
I suspect that the Qataris will be quite concerned about the public relations follow this and will be concerned about the potential for boycotts, particularly by sponsors who may not want to be associated with what is happening on the migrant front or what the treatment of migrant workers. Now, perhaps the story will pass by the time we get to the World Cup next year. But I do think that there is an opening here for pressure on the Qataris to at least change things going forward, just given the fact that they are hosting the World Cup partly to sort of show themselves to the world. And this is not a particularly good image to be showing to the world. And I'll just note, in the past, when there were accusations about the Qataris relying on North Korean workers, as a matter of fact, you may recall, Bob, there were ads about this showing up on cable television stations here in Northern Virginia, designed purposely to try to create a message to get the Qataris to think that it's in their own interest to do better and to clean things up. And I think there was some sense that that effort did put pressure on the government in Doha.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. A major conference on energy issues, Africa Energy in Daba 2021, is held virtually. OPEC and non-OPEC ministers will meet, and parliamentary elections are taking place in El Salvador.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe did double duty as a recording engineer. As always, thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be healthy out there.